But Paul says, I'm worried that the serpent is going to beguile you and make the gospel complicated when God never made it complicated any more than he made the original command in Eden complicated. 1 Timothy 4:1 says, now the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. You mean demons study doctrine? Demons have teachings? Apparently they do. I would submit to you that when Muhammad received a collection of teachings, which are now recorded in the Quran and the Hadith, called Islam, allegedly coming from the angel Gabriel, I would suggest to you that Muhammad was not in contact with the angel Gabriel. I would suggest to you that he was in contact with either Satan himself or a demon masquerading as an angel of light. When Joseph Smith had his revelation that gave birth to Mormonism as a very young person, supposedly the angel Moroni revealed these truths to Joseph Smith and gave us the cult of Mormonism, I would suggest to you that the angel that showed up and gave this vision to Joseph Smith was not a true angel of God at all, but it was an angel masquerading as a demon, an angel of light, I should say. Angel of light, masquerading. Demons are very good at giving us false teachings and false doctrines. And I've been thinking about this for a while. Who does Satan operate on over time in the body of Christ? I think he operates on teachers and people within that have the ability through teaching to sway other people. Isn't that why James 3 and verse 1 says, let few of you presume to be teachers, knowing that the teacher will incur the what? Stricter judgment. And Satan can put strange ideas into the mind of a teacher, knowing that that teacher will communicate that to a larger audience and sway that audience in a negative direction. Satan is largely targeting people that have influence within the Church of Christ. You say, wait a minute. Are you telling me that Satan can influence a believer? I'm not telling you that. The Bible's telling you that. Peter opened his mouth one day, thought he had a good thought, tried to talk Jesus out of the cross. He tells Jesus, you know, going to the cross wouldn't be a good career move for you at this time. You're the Messiah. And Jesus says to Peter, get behind me what? Satan. Was Peter a saved person? Of course he was. Or take Ananias and Sapphira. Their hearts, Satan had plerao, filled their hearts. And they lied to the Spirit. I believe that they were believers also, because when God struck them dead, the whole church was afraid. If an unbeliever gets struck dead, that's one thing, but now one of our own has been struck dead. And this had a purifying effect on the early church. Or the book of Ephesians, do not let the sun go down on your anger, lest you give the devil a foothold. Can Satan possess a believer? No. Because God and Satan don't make good roommates. Can Satan influence a believer? Absolutely. Whenever we don't have the full armor of God on and we go back to the sin nature and we're not in the Word and we're not in prayer, Satan will use whatever inroad you give him to influence you negatively. And he works so hard on people that are teachers or others that have influence in the body of Christ, knowing that if he can take them down the wrong road, he can take the church down the wrong road. Satan, or apostasy, ultimately is satanic at its source. Satan does whatever he can to get the church out of its game. Because the church has power when it functions under God's blueprint. The church, as we have said, has three functions: to glorify God, edify the saints, and fulfill the Great Commission. Satan loves to get the church away from those priorities. Likes to get us into kingdom building or any other activity, because he knows that if we function outside of the blueprint of God, the church is emptied of its power. Number 8, apostasy is destructive. Behind the wake of apostasy are bleeding sheep, bruised feelings, and a spiritual body count. See, we understand physical harm with the Tylenol scare. We got that down. But we have a hard time believing that apostasy and false teaching creates spiritual harm. And yet, what imagery does Paul use to describe apostasy? For I know this, that after my departure, savage wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. Think of a wolf devouring innocent sheep. That's the metaphor Paul uses to describe apostasy. Or 1 Timothy 1:19, having faith and a good conscience, which some have rejected concerning the faith, have suffered shipwreck. You watch the movie The Titanic, all of the loss of property and, more important, the loss of life that happened because this giant ship hit that iceberg there in the Atlantic Ocean. That's sort of the imagery that Paul uses to describe apostasy coming into the church. Or look at this imagery, 2 Timothy 2:17 and 18. And their talk will spread like gangrene. Some versions translate that as cancer. We all understand what cancer does to people. Paul says there's spiritual gangrene, spiritual cancer. Their talk will spread like gangrene, and among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, mentions names there, men who have gone astray from the truth, saying that the resurrection has already taken place, and they have, watch this, upset the faith of some. I looked at that word, upset or unsettle. You know, that's the same verb used to describe Jesus going into the temple and overturning the tables of the money changers. What did he do to those tables? He completely unsettled them. And in the same way, false doctrine comes into the church and it completely upsets or unsettles the faith of some. See, apostasy is destructive. So we're warned about it over and over again. Number 9. Apostasy makes life difficult for the man or woman of God. Back to 2 Timothy 3:13, the warning of apostasy. But evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. 2 Timothy 4:3 and 4 says, for the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers that will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. I spent an entire Sunday morning recently on our website. You can get this just on this verse. We're going through these verses, currently going through 2 Timothy. And I don't know how that verse strikes you. You know how it strikes me? That is a spitting image of the modern-day church growth movement. Because what is the church growth movement, whether it comes from Robert Schuller and the Crystal Cathedral, whether it comes from Rick Warren, whether it comes from Bill and Lynn Hybels at Willow Creek Community Church in Chicago, what are they saying with this new church growth model? You have to make the church comfortable. You have to go out and you have to poll through sociological data collection the desires of unchurched Mary or Harry. You figure out what the unsaved want in the church. What do they want? They want skits. They want entertainment. They want messages that are relevant to their lives. How can I be a better businessman? Things of that nature. Self-help type talks. They don't want to feel bad about themselves or guilty in any sense. So what you do is you develop a church like what people want. And people will come. And guess what? It works. You can pack out stadiums doing this. The problem is, you get to the end game, and is this really a church anymore? You look at what's happening with a crowd of people, and you look at the Bible, and you're saying, this is not God's church any longer. This is the creation of man.